cobweb, but better to stay away from it. And here I screw up. I should have Kirill walk next to me, wait until his eyes get used to the dark, and show him the cobweb, point right at it. But I'm used to working alone. My eyes adjust to the light, and I don't think about Kirill. I step inside and head straight for the canisters. I squat by the empty. There aren't any cobwebs stuck to it. I take one end of it. All right, grab hold, I say, and don't drop it. It's heavy. I look up at him, and my heart leaps into my throat. I can't say a word. I want to yell, stop, don't move, and can't. And there probably isn't enough time anyway. It all happens so fast. Kirill steps over the empty, turns around, and his back goes right into the silver stuff. The only thing I can do is close my eyes. I feel weak all over. Can't hear a thing. Just the sound of the cobweb tearing with a faint crackle like a regular cobweb, except louder, of course. I'm crouching there with my eyes closed. Can't feel my hands or my feet. Then Kirill says, well, are we picking it up? Let's do it, I say. We pick up the empty and, walking sideways, carry it to the exit. The damn thing is heavy. It's hard to carry, even for the two of us. We go out into the sun and stop near the boot. Tender is reaching his paws toward us already. All right, says Kirill. One, two, no, I say. Wait. Put it down first. We put it down. Turn around, I say. He turns without a word. I look. There's nothing on his back. I check this way and that. Still nothing. Then I look around and check the canisters. Nothing there either. Listen, I say to Kirill, still looking at the canisters. Did you see the cobweb? What cobweb? Where? Never mind, I say. The Lord is merciful. Meanwhile, I think, actually, that remains to be seen. All right, I say. Grab hold. We load the empty onto the boot and put it on its side so it won't roll around. It's standing there, looking lovely, spotless, new, the copper gleaming in the sun, the blue filling swirling slowly between the copper disks and cloudy streams. It's now obvious that it isn't an empty, but a container, like a glass jar with blue syrup inside. We admire it for a bit, then clamber up into the boot ourselves, and without further ado, are on our way back. These scientists sure have it easy. First of all, they work in the daylight, and second, the only hard part is getting into the zone. On the way back, the boot drives itself. It has this feature, a route memorizer, I guess, that takes the boot back along the exact same route it took here. We're floating back, repeating each maneuver, stopping, hanging in the air a bit, then continuing. We pass over all the nuts. I could pick them up if I wanted to. Of course, my novices immediately cheer up. They're looking this way and that, their fear almost gone. Only curiosity left and joy that everything ended well. They begin to chatter. Tender is waving his arms and threatening to come right back into the zone after dinner to lay a path to the garage. Kirill takes me by the sleeve and starts explaining his graviconcentrate to me, that is, the bug trap. Well, eventually I have to shut them up. I calmly explain to them how many idiots become careless with relief and kick the bucket on their way back. Be quiet, I tell them, and keep your eyes open, or you'll meet the fate of Shorty Linden. That works. They didn't even ask me what happened to Shorty Linden. Much better. In the zone, you can easily take a familiar route 100 times and kick off on 101st. We're floating in silence, and only one thing is on my mind. How I'll twist the cap off the flask. I keep visualizing how I'll take the first sip. But the cobweb occasionally flickers before my mind's eye. In short, we make it out of the zone, and they send us, still in our boot, into the delouser, or, as the scientists say, the sanitation hangar. They wash us in 3 boiling liquids and 3 alkaline solutions, smear some crap on us, sprinkle us with powder, and wash us again, then dry us, and say, "Get going, guys, you're free." Tender and Kirill drag the empty along. People show up in droves. It's hard to get through, and it's so typical. Everyone is staring and shouting greetings, but no one is brave enough to lend a hand to 3 tired men. Oh, well, that's none of my business. Nothing is my business anymore. I pull the spec suit off and throw it on the floor. The sergeant lackeys will pick it up. Then I head for the showers, since I'm soaked from head to toe. I lock myself in the stall, take out the flask, unscrew it, and attach myself to it like a leech. I'm sitting on the bench. My heart is empty. My head is empty. My soul is empty, gulping down the hard stuff like water. Alive. I got out. The zone let me out. Damn hag, my lifeblood, traitorous bitch. Alive. The novices can't understand this. No one but a stalker can understand it. And tears are pouring down my face, maybe from the booze, maybe from something else. I suck the flask dry. I'm wet. The flask is dry. As usual, I need just one more sip. Oh, well, we'll fix that. We can fix anything now. Alive. I light a cigarette and stay seated. I can feel it. I'm coming around. The bonus comes to mind. Here at the Institute, that's a given. I could go get the envelope this very minute. Or maybe they'll bring it right to the showers. I slowly undress. I take off my watch and look at it. My Lord, we were in the zone for more than 5 hours. 5 hours. I shudder. Yes, my friends, there's no such thing as time in the zone. Although really, what's 5 hours to a stalker? Nothing at all. You want 12 hours instead, or maybe 2 whole days? When you don't finish in one night, you stay in the zone all day long, face down in the dirt. You can't even pray properly, but can only rave deliriously, and you don't know if you are dead or alive. And the next night, when you finish, you try to get out with the swag, except the guards are patrolling the borders with machine guns, and those toads hate you. They get no pleasure from arresting you. The bastards are scared to death that you might be contagious. They just want to shoot you down. And they're holding all the cards. Go ahead and prove later that they killed you illegally. So, there you are again, face down in the dirt, praying until dawn, and until dusk. The swag lying beside you, and you don't even know if it's simply lying there or slowly killing you. Or maybe you'll end up like Knuckles Isaac. He got stuck in an open area at dawn, lost his way, and wound up between 2 ditches. Couldn't go left or right. They shot at him for 2 hours. Couldn't hit him. For 2 hours, he played dead. Thank God they finally got tired of it. Figured he was finished and left. I saw him after that. I didn't recognize him. They broke him. Left only a shell of a man. I wipe away my tears and turn on the water. I take a long shower, first in hot water and then in cold water, and again in hot water. I use up a whole bar of soap. Eventually I get sick of it. I turn the water off and immediately hear rapping on the door and Kirill yelling cheerfully, "Hey, stalker, come on out! It smells like money out here." Money. It's always good news. I open the door, Kirill standing there, wearing only boxer shorts and great spirits, no sign of melancholy, and he's handing me an envelope. "Take it," he says, "from Grateful Humanity." Screw Grateful Humanity. How much is it? "For extraordinary courage under danger, just this once, 2 months' pay." Ah, that's real money. If they paid me 2 months' salary for every empty I brought in, I'd have told Ernest to fuck off a long time ago. "So, are you happy?" says Kirill, beaming, grinning from ear to ear. "I'm all right," I say. "How about you?" He doesn't say anything. He grabs me around the neck, presses me to his sweaty chest, hugs me, then pushes me away and disappears into the next stall. "Hey," I shout after him. "Where's Tender? Washing out his undies, I bet." "No way. Tender is surrounded by reporters. You should see how important he's gotten. He's giving them a real perspicuous account." "What kind of account?" I say. "A perspicuous one." "All right," I say. "Sir, next time I'll bring a dictionary, sir." Then I feel an electric shock go through me. "Wait, Kirill," I say. "Come out here." "But I'm naked already," he says. "Come out. I'm not a girl." "All right." He comes out. I take him by the shoulders and turn his back toward me. No, I imagined it. His back is clean. Nothing on it except some rivulets of dried sweat. "What's with you in my back?" he asks. I kick his naked ass, dive into my stall, and lock the door. Nerves. God damn it. I keep imagining things. First there, now here. To hell with it all. I'll get plastered tonight. I gotta beat Richard. That's the thing. Bastard sure knows how to play. You can't win no matter what you're dealt. I tried cheating, even blessing the cards under the table. Nothing worked. "Kirill," I yell, "are you going to the borscht today?" "It's pronounced borscht, not borscht. How many times do I have to tell you? Cut it out. The sign says borscht. Don't you try to force your customs on us. Are you coming or not? I'd like to beat Richard." "I'm not sure, Red, you simple soul. You don't even understand what we found today." "And you do?" "To be honest, I don't either. That's fair, but at least now we know what these empties were used for, and if one of my ideas works out, I'll write a paper and dedicate it to you personally, to Red Shuhart, honored stalker, with reverence and gratitude. And then they'll put me away for 2 years, I say. But you'll go down in science. This thing will forever be known as Shuhart's Jar. Sound good?" While we're joking around, I get dressed. I stuff the empty flask into my pocket, count the money again, and get on my way. "Have a good shower, you complicated soul." He doesn't reply. The water's very loud. In the hallway, I see Mr. Tender himself, completely red and strutting like a peacock. A crowd is formed around him. Co-workers, journalists, even a few sergeants, fresh from dinner, picking their teeth. And he's blathering on. "The technology we command practically guarantees a safe and successful expedition." Here, he notices me and immediately dries up, smiling and waving tentatively. Shit, I think I need to escape. I take off, but it's too late. I hear footsteps behind me. "Mr. Shuhart, Mr. Shuhart, a few words about the garage." "No comment," I reply, breaking into a run, but I can't get away. A guy with a mic is on my right, and another one with a camera is on my left. "Did you see anything unusual in the garage? Please, just 2 words." "I have no comment," I repeat, trying to keep the back of my head to the camera. "It's just a garage. Thank you. What do you think about the turbo platforms?" "They're great," I say, heading straight for the John. "What's your opinion about the goals of the visit?" "Talk to the scientists," I say, and I slide into the bathroom. I hear them scratching at the door, so I call out, "I highly recommend you ask Mr. Tender why his nose looks like a plum. He's too modest to mention it, but that was our most exciting adventure." Man, they shoot down the hallway just like horses, I swear. I wait a minute. Silence. I stick my head out. No one's around. So I walk away, whistling. I go down to the lobby, show my idea to the beefy sergeant. Then I see that he's saluting me. Guess I'm the hero of the day. "At ease, Sergeant," I say. "I'm pleased with you." He flashes a huge grin at me as if I paid him the greatest compliment. "Good job, Red," he says. "I'm proud to know you." "Well," I say, "you'll have something to tell the girls back in Sweden, huh?" "Hell yeah," he says. "They'll be all over me." Really, the guy's okay. To be honest, I don't like those hale and hearty types. The girls go crazy over them, and for what? It just can't be the height. I'm walking along the street trying to figure out what it could be. The sun is shining, no one's around. And suddenly, I want to see Gouda real bad. Not for any particular reason, just to look at her, hold her hand. That's about all you can manage after the zone. hand-holding, especially when you remember the stories about the children of stalkers, how they turn out. No, I shouldn't even be thinking about Gouda. First, I need a bottle, at least, of the strong stuff. I pass the parking lot, then I see the checkpoint. Two patrol cars are waiting there in all their glory. Wide, yellow, bristling with searchlights and machine guns. And, of course, a whole crowd of cops is blocking the street. I walk along, looking down so I won't see their faces. It's best if I don't look at them in broad daylight. A couple of guys there I'm afraid to recognize. It'd be one hell of a scene if I did. I swear they're lucky that Kirill convinced me to work for the Institute, otherwise I'd have found the assholes and finished them off. I'm pushing my way through the crowd, almost past it, when I hear, "Hey, stalker!" Well, it has nothing to do with me, so I keep walking, pulling a cigarette from the pack. Someone catches up with me and grabs my sleeve. I shake his hand off, turn halfway toward him, and inquire politely, "What the hell are you grabbing my sleeve for, mister?" "Wait, stalker," he says. "Two questions for you." I look up at him. It's my old friend, Captain Quarterblad. He's completely dried up and turned a shade of yellow. "Hello, Captain," I say. "How's the liver?" "Don't you try to distract me, stalker," he says angrily, boring his eyes into me. "You better explain to me why you don't stop immediately when called." And two cops instantly appear behind him, pawing their guns. Can't see their eyes, just their jaws working away under the helmets. Where in the world do they find these guys? Did they send them to Harmont to breed, or what? I'm not usually afraid of the guards in the daytime, but the toads could search me, and that wouldn't suit me at all right now. "I didn't know you meant me, Captain," I say. "You were yelling at some stalker." "Oh, and you aren't a stalker anymore." "I've served my time, thanks to you, and I've given it up since," I say. "I'm done with it. Thank you, Captain, for opening my eyes. If not for you, what were you doing in the restricted area?" "What do you mean? I work here for 2 years now." And to finish this unpleasant conversation, I take out my ID and show it to Captain Quarterblad. He takes it, examines it, practically sniffs the seals, and seems almost ready to lick it. He returns my ID, looking satisfied. His eyes have lit up, even his cheeks colored. "Sorry, Shuhart," he says. "I didn't expect this. That means my advice to you didn't go to waste. Really, that's great. Believe it or not, I always figured you'd make something of yourself. I just couldn't imagine that a guy like you," and off he goes. Well, I think just my luck to cure another melancholic. Of course, I listened to him, looking down in embarrassment, nodding, gesturing awkwardly, and even shyly towing the pavement. The goons behind the captain listen for a while, then get queasy, I bet, and go off somewhere more exciting. Meanwhile, the captain drones on about my future. Knowledge is light, ignorance is darkness. God always values and rewards honest labor. Anyway, he tries to feed me the same boring bullshit that the jail priests harassed us with every Sunday, and I need a drink. I just can't wait. All right, I think, Red, you can endure even this. Patience, Red, patience. Can't go on like this for long. He's already out of breath. And then, to my relief, one of the patrol cars signals to us. Captain Quarterblad looks around, grunts in annoyance, and extends his hand to me. "All right," he says. "It was nice to meet you, honest man, Shuhart. I would have been happy to drink with you to that. Can't have anything too strong, doctor's orders, but I could have had a beer with you. But you see, duty calls." "Well, we'll meet again," he says. God forbid, I think. But I shake his hand and keep blushing and towing the pavement, doing everything he wants me to. And he finally leaves, and I make a beeline for the borscht. The borscht is always empty at this hour. Ernest is standing behind the bar, wiping the glasses and holding them up to the light. Any time you come in, these barmen are always wiping glasses, as if their salvation depended on it. He'll stand here all day, pick up a glass, squint at it, hold it up to the light, breathe on it, and get wiping. He'll do that for a bit, take another look, this time through the bottom of the glass, and start wiping again. Hey, Ernie, I say, leave that thing alone. You'll wipe a hole through it. He looks at me through the glass, grumbles something indistinct, and without saying a word, pours me a shot of vodka. I clamber up onto the stool, take a sip, grimace, shake my head, and take another sip. The fridge is humming. The jukebox is playing something quiet. Ernest is puffing into another glass. It's nice and peaceful. I finish my drink, putting my glass on the bar. Ernest immediately pours me another one. Feeling better, he mutters. Thawing a bit, stalker. You just keep wiping, I say. You know, one guy wiped for a while, and he finally summoned an evil spirit. He had a great life after that. Who was this? Asks Ernest suspiciously. He was a barman here, I answer, before your time. So what happened? Oh, nothing. Why do you think we got a visit? He just wouldn't stop wiping. Who do you figure visited us, huh? Ah, you're full of it today, says Ernie with approval. He goes to the kitchen and comes back with a plate of fried sausages. He puts the plate in front of me, passes me the ketchup, and returns to his glasses. Ernest knows his stuff. He's got an eye for these things, can instantly tell when a stalker's fresh from the zone, when he's got swag, and Ernie knows what a stalker needs. Ernie's a good guy, our benefactor. After I finish the sausages, I light a cigarette and try to estimate how much money Ernest is making on us. I don't know the going prices in Europe, but I've heard rumors that an empty sells for almost $2,500, while Ernie only gives us $400. The batteries go for at least $100, and we're lucky to get $20. That's probably how it is for everything. Of course, getting the swag to Europe must cost a bundle. You got to grease a lot of palms. Even the station master's probably paid off. Anyway, if you think about it, Ernest doesn't pocket that much, 15 to 20% at the most, and if he gets caught, that's 10 years of hard labor, guaranteed. Here, my generous meditations are interrupted by some polite type. I don't even hear him coming in, but here he is at my right elbow asking, "May I sit down?" "Of course," I reply. "Go right ahead." It's a skinny little guy with a pointy nose wearing a bow tie. He looks familiar. I've seen him somewhere before, but I can't remember where. He climbs onto a nearby stool and says to Ernie, "Bourbon, please." And immediately to me, "Excuse me, I think we've met. You work at the International Institute, right?" "Yes," I say. "And you?" He promptly pulls a business card out of his pocket and puts it in front of me. I read, "Aloysius McNaught, immigration agent." Right. Of course I know him. He pesters people to leave town. Someone must really want us all to leave Harmont. Almost half the population is already gone, but no, they have to get rid of everyone. I push his card away with one finger and tell him, "No thanks. I'm not interested. I dream of living my entire life in my hometown." "But why?" he asks eagerly. "I mean, no offense, but what's keeping you here?" "Right, like I'll tell him what really is." "What a question," I say. "Sweet childhood memories, my first kiss in the park, my mommy and daddy, the first time I got drunk in this very bar, our police station so dear to my heart." I take a heavily used handkerchief out of my pocket and put it to my eyes. "No," I say, "no way." He laughs, takes a small sip of bourbon and says thoughtfully, "I can't understand you people. Life in Harmont is hard. The city is under military control. The provisions are mediocre. The zone is so close. It's like living on top of a volcano. An epidemic could break out at any moment, or something even worse. I understand the old folks. They're used to this place. They don't want to leave. But someone like you, how old are you? Can't be more than 22, 23. You have to understand, our agency is a non-profit. There's no one paying us to do this. We just want people to leave this hellhole, to return to normal life. Look, we even cover the costs of relocation. We find you work after you move. For somebody young like you, we pay for your education." "No, I don't get it." "What?" I say. "No one wants to leave?" "No, not exactly no one. Some do agree, especially people with families, but not the young or the old. What is it about this place? It's just a hole, a provincial town. And here I give it to him. Mr. Aloysius McNaught, I say. You're absolutely right. Our little town is a hole. Always was and always will be, except right now, I say. It's a hole into the future. And the stuff we fish out of this hole will change your whole stinking world. Life will be different, the way it should be. And no one will want for anything. That's our hole for you. There's knowledge pouring through this hole. And when we figure it out, we'll make everyone rich and we'll fly to the stars. We'll go wherever we want. That's the kind of hole we have here. At this point, I trail off because I notice that Ernie is looking at me in astonishment and I feel embarrassed. In general, I don't like using other people's words, even if I do happen to like them, especially since they came out kind of funny. When Kirill's talking, you can't stop listening. You almost forget to close your mouth. And here I'm saying the same stuff, but something seems off. Maybe that's because Kirill never slipped Ernie swag under the counter. Oh, well. Here my Ernie comes to and hurriedly pours me a large shot. Snap out of it, man. What's wrong with you today? Meanwhile, the pointy-nosed Mr. McNaught takes another sip of bourbon and says, "Yes, of course, the perpetual batteries, the blue panacea. But do you actually think it'll be like you said?" "What I actually think is none of your business," I say. "I was talking about the town. Now, speaking for myself, I'll say, what's so great about your Europe? The eternal boredom? You work all day, watch TV all night. When that's done, you're off to bed with some bitch breeding delinquents. The strikes, the demonstrations, the never-ending politics. To hell with your Europe."
"Really? Why does it have to be Europe?"
"Oh," I say, "it's the same story all over. And in the Antarctic, it's cold, too." And you know the amazing thing? I'm telling him this, and I completely believe in what I'm saying. And our zone, the evil bitch, the murderess, is at that moment 100 times dearer to me than all their Europes and Africas. And I'm not even drunk yet. Simply imagine for a moment how I'd come home strung out after work in a herd of like-minded drones, how I'd get squashed on all sides in their subway, how I'd become jaded and weary of life. "What do you say?" he asks Ernie. "I'm a businessman," Ernie replies with authority. "I'm not some young punk. I've invested money in this business. The commandant comes in here sometimes. A general, nothing to sneeze at. Why would I leave?" Mr. Aloysius McNaught starts telling him something with numbers, but I'm no longer listening. I take a good swig from my glass, get some change from my pocket, climb down from the stool, and go over to the jukebox to get things going. They have this one song here called "Don't Come Back Unless You're Ready." It does wonders for me after the zone. All right, the jukebox is screeching away, so I pick up my glass and go into the corner to settle scores with the one-armed bandit. And time begins to fly. Just as I'm losing my last nickel, Gutelin and Richard Noonan barge into our friendly establishment. Gutelin is plastered already, rolling his eyes and looking to pick a fight, while Richard Noonan is tenderly holding on to his elbow and distracting him with jokes. A pretty pair. Gutelin is huge, curly-haired, and as black as an officer's boot, with arms down to his knees, while Dick is small, round, pink, and mellow. Practically aglow. "Hey," yells Dick when he sees me. "Red's here, too. Come here, Red." "That's right," bellows Gutelin. "There are only 2 people in this town, Red and me. All the others are pigs, spawns of Satan. Red, you also serve Satan, but you're still human." I come over to them with my glass. Gutelin grabs me by the coat, sits me down at their table, and says, "Sit down, Red, sit down, servant of Satan. I love you. Let's weep over the sins of humanity. Weep in despair."
Let us weep, I say, swallow the tears of sin. Because the day is nigh, proclaims Gudelin, because the pale horse has been saddled and the rider has put a foot in the stirrup, and futile are the prayers of the worshippers of Satan, and only those who renounce him shall be saved. Thou of human flesh, whom Satan has seduced, who play with his toys and covet his treasures, I tell thee, thou art blind. Awake, fools, before it's too late. Stamp on the devil's baubles. Here he comes to an abrupt halt, as if forgetting what's next. Can I get a drink in this place? He asks in a different voice. Where am I? You know, Red, I got fired again. An agitator, they said. I was telling him, awake, you're blind, plunging into the abyss and dragging the other blind men behind you. They just laughed. So I socked the boss in the face and left. Now they'll arrest me. And for what? Dick comes over and puts a bottle on the table. I'm paying today, I yell to Ernest. Dick looks sideways at me. It's all above board, I say. We'll be drinking on my bonus. You went into the zone, asks Dick. Did you bring anything out? A full empty, I say, for the altar to science and pocketfuls of joy. Are you going to pour or not? An empty, Gudelin rumbles sadly. You risk your life for some empty. You're still alive, but you brought another work of Satan into this world, and you just don't know, Red, how much sin and grief. Quiet, Gudelin, I tell him sternly. Eat, drink, and be merry, because I came back alive. A toast to success. That toast gets us going. Gudelin becomes completely depressed, sitting there sobbing, liquid gushing from his eyes like water from a faucet. It's okay. I've seen him do this. It's one of his stages. Streaming tears and preaching that Satan put the zone there to tempt us, that you can't take anything out of it. And if you do, put it back and live your life as if the zone didn't exist. Leave Satan's work for Satan. I like him, Gudelin. I like eccentrics in general. When he has enough money, he buys swag from anyone without haggling, and then he sneaks into the zone at night and buries it there. Lord, is he bawling. Oh, well, he'll cheer up yet. What's a full empty? Asked Dick. I've heard of empties, but what's a full one? Never heard of it. I explain it to him. He nods, smacks his lips. Yes, he says. That's interesting. That's something new. Who did you go with? The Russian guy? Yeah, I reply. I went with Kirill and Tender, you know, our lab assistant. You must have had your hands full with them. Not at all. They both did pretty well, especially Kirill. He's a born stalker, I'd say. If he had more experience, learned some proper patience, I'd go into the zone with him every day. And every night? He asks with a drunken laugh. Stop that, I say. Enough with the jokes. I know, he says. Enough with the jokes, or I might get a punch in the face. Let's say you can take a couple swings at me sometime. Who's getting punched? Gudelin comes to life. Which one of you? We grab his arms, barely getting him into his seat. Dick sticks a cigarette in his teeth and lights it. We calm him down. Meanwhile, people keep coming in. There's no room left at the bar, and most tables are taken. Ernest has called up his girls, and they're running around fetching drinks, beer for some, cocktails or vodka for others. Lately, I've been noticing a lot of new faces in town, young punks with colorful scarves down to the floor. I mention this to Dick, and he nods. That's right, he says. They're starting a lot of construction. The Institute's putting up 3 new buildings, and they're also going to wall off the zone from the cemetery to the old ranch. The good times for stalkers are coming to an end. Like we stalkers ever had them, I say. At the same time, I think, what the hell is this? That means I won't be able to work on the side. Ah, well, might be for the best. Less temptation. I'll go into the zone during the day, like an honest man. The money isn't as good, of course, but it's much safer. There's the boot, the spec suits, and all that crap, and I won't give a damn about patrols. I can live on my salary, and I'll
drink my bonuses. Now I get really depressed. I'll have to count every cent again. This I can afford, that I can't. I'll have to pinch pennies for Gouda's gifts. No more bars, only cheap movies. And everything's gray, all gray, gray every day and every evening and every night. I sit there thinking this while Dick keeps buzzing in my ear. Last night I go to the hotel bar for a late-night drink, and I see some new faces in there. I didn't like them from the start. One of them comes over and starts working up to something, tells me he knows about me, knows who I am and what I do, and hints that he'll pay good money for certain services. An informer, I say. I'm not too interested in all this. I've seen my share of informers and heard plenty of talk about services. No, my friend, not an informer. You listen. I talk to him for a bit, being careful, of course, playing the fool. He's interested in certain items from the zone, and these items are no joke. Trinkets like batteries, shriekers, and black sparks aren't for him, and he only hinted at what he does need. So, what exactly does he need? I asked. Hell slime, if I understood correctly, Dick says, and gives me a strange look. Ah, so he needs hell slime, I say. Maybe he'd like a death lamp as well. I asked him about that, too. Well, believe it or not, he does. Yeah, I say. Then he can go get them himself. It's easy as pie. We have basements full of hell slime. He could take a bucket and dip right in. It's his funeral. Dick stays silent, looks at me from beneath his brows, and doesn't even smile. What the hell, is he trying to hire me or something? And then it clicks. Wait, I say. Who could that have been? We aren't even allowed to study the hell slime at the Institute. Exactly, says Dick deliberately, keeping his eyes on me. It's research that might pose a danger to humanity. Now do you understand who that was? I don't understand a thing. An alien, I say. He bursts out laughing and pats me on the arm. Why don't we have a drink, you simple soul? Why don't we? I reply, although I feel mad. Screw this. Enough of this simple soul business, bastards. Hey, Goodlin, I say, wake up. Let's have a drink. Now, Goodlin's asleep. He's put his black face down on the black table and is asleep. Arms hanging to the floor. Dick and I have a drink without Goodlin. All right, I say. It might be a simple or complicated soul, but I'd report this guy. I have no love for the police, but I'd go and report him myself. Yeah, says Dick. And the police would ask you, why exactly did this fella come to you with his offers, I shake my head. Doesn't matter. You fat pig, you spent 3 years in town, but you haven't been in the zone, and you've only seen hell slime in the movies. And if you saw it in real life, saw what it does to a man, you shit your pants right there. This is awful stuff, my friend. You shouldn't take it out of the zone. As you know, stalkers are crude men. They only care about the money. The more the better. But even the late slug wouldn't go for this. The vulture Burbridge wouldn't do it. I can't even imagine who would want hell slime and what they'd want it for. Well, says Dick, that's all very admirable. But you see, I don't want to be found dead in bed one morning with a suicide note beside me. I'm not a stalker, but I'm also a crude and practical man, and I happen to like life. I've been alive for a while. I'm used to it. Here, Ernest suddenly hollers from behind the bar. Mr. Noonan, phone for you. Damn it, says Dick viciously. It's probably the claims department again. They always track me down. Give me a minute, Red. He gets up and goes to the phone. I stay with Goodlin and the bottle, and since Goodlin is of no use, I get real chummy with the bottle. Damn that zone. There's no getting away from it. Wherever you go, whoever you talk to, it's always the zone, the zone, the zone. It's very nice for Kirill to argue that the zone will help bring about world peace and eternal sunshine. Kirill is a great guy. No one would call him dumb. In fact, he's smart as they come. But he doesn't know shit about life. He can't even imagine the scum that gathers around the zone. Here, take a look. Someone wants hell slime. No, Gudlin might be a drunk and a religious fanatic, but sometimes you think about it and you wonder, maybe we really should leave Satan's work for Satan. Hands off the shit. Here's some punk wearing a colorful scarf, sits down in Dick's seat. Mr. Shuhart, he asks. Yes, I say. My name's Creon, he says. I'm from Malta. Okay, I say, and how are things in Malta? Things in Malta are all right, but that's not why I'm here. Ernest referred me to you. Ah, I think. Ernest is a bastard, after all. He's got no pity. None at all. Look at this kid. Dark-skinned, innocent, good-looking. He's probably never shaved and has never kissed a girl. But what's that to Ernie? He just wants to herd us all into the zone. If one out of three returns with swag, that's a profit already. Well, and how's old Ernie doing, I ask? He turns around to look at the bar and says, as far as I can tell, he's doing pretty well. I'd trade with him. I wouldn't, I say. Want a drink? Thank you, I don't drink. How about a smoke? Sorry, I don't smoke either. God damn it, I say. And what do you need money for? He reddens, stops smiling, and says softly, that's probably my own business, right, Mr. Shuhart? Can't argue with that, I say, and pour myself a shot. By now my head is buzzing and my limbs feel pleasantly relaxed. The zone is completely let go. Right now I'm drunk, I say, celebrating, as you can see. Went into the zone, came back alive, and with money. It's not often you come back alive, and the money is real rare, so let's postpone the serious discussion. He jumps up, says he's sorry, and I see that Dick is back. He's standing next to his chair, and from his face I can tell that something happened. Well, I ask, are your containers leaking again? Yeah, he says, them again. He sits down, pours himself a drink, and tops mine off, and I see that this isn't about the claims department. To be honest, he doesn't give a damn about them. Real hard worker. Let's have a drink, Red, he says. Without waiting for me, he gulps down his drink and pours another one. You know, he says, Kirill Penoff died. I don't even understand through the stupor. So, someone's dead. That's too bad. All right, I say, let's drink to the departed. He stares at me, wide-eyed, and only then do I feel my insides turn to mush. I get up, lean on my hands, and look down at him. Kirill? And the silver cobweb is in front of me, and again I hear it crackle as it tears. And through this terrible sound, I hear Dick's voice as if coming from another room. A heart attack. They found him in the shower, naked. No one understands a thing. They asked about you, and I said you were perfectly fine. What's there to understand, I say. It's the zone. Sit down, says Dick. Sit down and have a drink. The zone, I repeat. And I can't stop. The zone. The zone. I see nothing but the silver cobweb. The whole bar is tangled in the cobweb. People are moving around, and the web crackles softly as they touch it. And at the center of it is the Maltese boy, his face childlike and surprised. He doesn't understand a thing. Kid, I tell him tenderly. How much money do you need? Is 1,000 enough? Take it. Take it. I shove the money at him and shout, go to Ernest and tell him he's an asshole and a bastard. Don't be afraid. Tell him. He's nothing but a coward.
Tell him, and then go straight to the station, buy yourself a ticket back to Malta. Don't stop anywhere. I don't know what else I'm shouting. The next thing I know, I'm in front of the bar. Ernest puts a drink in front of me and asks, "You got money today?" "Yeah, I got money," I say. "Can you pay your tab? I have to pay taxes tomorrow." And now I see that I'm holding a wad of cash. I'm looking at this dough and mumbling, "Oh, I guess he didn't take it, Creon from Malta. Too proud, probably. Well, the rest is fate." "What's wrong with you?" asked my buddy Ernie. "Drank a bit much?" "No," I say, "I'm totally fine, up for anything." "You should go home," says Ernie. "You drank too much." "Kirill died," I tell him. "Which Kirill? The mangy one?" "You're mangy yourself, bastard," I tell him. "You couldn't make one Kirill out of 1,000 of you. You're an asshole," I say, "a stinking hustler. You're dealing death, you jerk. You bought us all with your money. You want me to take this place apart for you?" And just as I take a swing, somebody suddenly grabs me and drags me away, and I'm no longer thinking, and I don't even want to try. I'm screaming, punching, kicking someone. Then I finally come to. I'm sitting in the bathroom, completely wet, and my face is bloody. I look in the mirror. I don't recognize myself, and there's a tick in my cheek. That's never happened before. And there are noises coming from the barroom, crashes, and the sound of dishes breaking. Girls are squealing, and I hear Gudlin roaring like a polar bear in heat. "Get away, bastards! Where's Red? What'd you do with Red? Satan's spawn!" Then the wail of a police siren. And as soon as I hear it, everything becomes clear. I remember, know, and understand everything, and there's nothing left in my soul except icy fury. "All right," I think. "Now I'll get even with you, you stinking hustler. I'll show you what a stalker can do." I take a shrieker out of my pocket, a nice new, unused one, squeeze it a few times to get it going, open the door to the bar room, and quietly throw it in. Then I open the window and climb out to the street. Of course, I really want to stay and watch the show, but I have to take off. I can't stand shriekers. They give me nosebleeds. As I run away, I hear my shrieker going at full blast. First, every dog in the neighborhood starts barking and howling. They always sense it first. Then an awful scream comes from the bar, loud enough to make my ears ring, even at that distance. I can just imagine the people running to and fro, some becoming melancholy, some violent, some scared out of their wits. A shrieker is a terrible thing. It'll be a while before Ernest gets a full bar again. Of course, the bastard will figure out who did it to him, but I don't give a shit. I'm done. No more stalker Red. I've had enough. I'm finished going to my death and teaching other idiots to do the same. "You are wrong, Kirill, my friend. I'm sorry, but it turns out that Gudlin was right, not you. We don't belong there. There's no good in the zone." I climb over the fence and slowly shuffle home. I'm biting my lip. I want to cry, but I can't. And there's nothing but emptiness ahead. Only boredom, melancholy, routine. Kirill, my only friend, how did we get here? What will I do without you? You painted the future for me, showed me a new world, a changed world, and now what? Someone in far-off Russia will cry for you, but I can't cry. And this is all my fault. No one else's. How could I? Damn fool, dare take him into the garage before his eyes got used to the dark. I've always been a lone wolf, never thought of anyone but myself. For once in my life, I decided to help someone, to give someone a gift. Why the hell did I even tell him about this empty? And when I realize this, something grabs me by the throat, enough to make me actually want to howl like a wolf. I probably really start howling. People begin to shy away from me, and then I suddenly feel a little better. I see Gutta coming. She's coming toward me, my beauty, my girl, showing her lovely legs, her skirt swaying above her knees as she walks. All the men ogle her as she passes by while she keeps walking straight, without looking around, and for some reason I immediately figure out she's looking for me. "Hey, Gutta," I say, "where are you heading?" She looks me over and quietly takes everything in. My bloody face and my wet jacket and my bruised knuckles. She doesn't mention any of this, but says instead, "Hey, Red, actually I was looking for you." "I know," I say. Let's go to my place. She stays silent, turns away, and looks to the side. Ah, what a head she has, what a neck. Like a spirited young filly, proud but already loyal to her master. Then she says, I don't know, Red. Maybe you won't want to see me anymore. My heart skips a beat. What does this mean? But I say calmly, I don't understand you, Gouda. I'm sorry. I've had a bit much today. Maybe I'm not thinking straight. Why wouldn't I want to see you anymore? I take her arm and we slowly walk to my house. And all the guys who were ogling her quickly hide their faces. I've lived on this street my entire life, and they all know Red Shoehart real well. The ones who don't know him would soon get a lesson, and they can feel it. My mom told me to get an abortion, Gouda says suddenly. But I don't want to. I have to walk another couple of steps before I get it. Meanwhile, Gouda keeps going. I don't want any abortions. I want to have your child. And you can do as you like. Take off if you want. I won't keep you. I'm listening to her as she's slowly getting mad, working herself up, listening, then gradually tuning out. I can't think straight at all. Only one stupid thought is spinning in my head. One person less in the world, one person more. She's been telling me, says Gouda. It's a stalker's child. Why breed freaks? He's a criminal, she says. You two won't have a family, nothing. Today he's free, tomorrow he's in jail. Except I don't care. I'll manage. I can handle everything myself. I'll give birth myself. I'll raise him myself. I'll make him human myself. I don't need you. Only don't you come near me. I won't let you in the door. Gouda, I say, my love, just wait a minute. And I can't go on. I'm breaking into stupid, nervous laughter. Honey, I say, why are you chasing me away, really? I'm shouting with laughter like a total idiot. Well, she stops, sticks her head into my chest, and starts bawling. What are we going to do now, Red? She says through her tears. What are we going to do now?
Chapter 2. Redrick Shoehart, 28 years old, married, no known occupation. Redrick Shoehart lay behind a tombstone and, holding a tree branch out of the way, looked at the road. The patrol car's searchlights darted around the cemetery, and when they flashed into his eyes, he squinted and held his breath. 2 hours had already passed, but the situation on the road hadn't changed. The car, motor rumbling steadily as it idled, stood in the same place and continued to probe with its searchlights, combing the unkempt, neglected graves, the slanted rusty crosses, the overgrown ash trees, and the crest of the 9-foot wall that ended to the left. The patrols were afraid of the zone. They never got out of the car. Here, near the cemetery, they didn't even have the guts to fire. Occasionally, Redrick heard muffled voices. Sometimes he'd see the flash of a cigarette butt fly out of the car and roll along the road, bouncing up and down and scattering dim reddish sparks. It was very damp. It had rained recently. And despite his waterproof coat, Redrick felt the wet chill. He carefully let go of the branch, turned his head and listened. To his right, not very far but close, he heard a noise. There was someone else in the cemetery. Over there, the leaves were rustling, soil was trickling down, and then something hard and heavy hit the ground with a soft thud. Redrick carefully crawled backward without turning around, flattening himself against the wet grass. Once again, a beam of light glided over his head. Redrick froze, following it with his eyes. He thought that on a grave between the crosses he saw a motionless man in black. The man sat there without concealing himself, leaning against the marble obelisk, turning a white face with sunken black eyes toward Redrick. Actually, Redrick didn't see him that clearly. He couldn't have in that instant, but he could imagine how it must look. He crawled for another few feet, felt the flask under his jacket, took it out, and lay there for some time, pressing the warm metal to his cheek. Then, without letting go of the flask, he crawled on. He no longer listened or looked around. There was a gap in the wall, and right next to it, on a spread-out lead-lined jacket, lay Burbridge. He was on his back, tugging at his collar with both hands, and was quietly, painfully groaning, the groans often turning into moans of agony. Redrick sat down next to him and unscrewed the flask. He carefully put his hand under Burbage's head, feeling the hot, sweaty, bald pate with his entire palm, and put the mouth of the flask to the old man's lips. It was dark, but in the dim, reflected glow of the searchlights, Redrick could see Burbage's wide-open, glassy eyes and the black stubble that covered his cheeks. Burbage took a few greedy gulps and started fidgeting, anxiously groping the bag of swag. "Came back," he said. "Good man, Red. Won't leave an old man to die." Redrick tilted his head back and took a big gulp. "Not moving, the damn thing," he said. "Like it's glued to the road." "That's no accident," said Burbridge. He was talking intermittently as he exhaled. "Someone squealed on us. They're waiting."
"Maybe," said Redrick. "Want any more?"
"No, that's enough. Don't leave me. If you stay, I'll make it. You won't be sorry. You won't leave, Red."
Redrick didn't answer. He was looking toward the road at the blue beams of searchlights. From here you could see the marble obelisk, but you couldn't tell whether that one was still sitting there or had vanished.
"Listen, Red, I'm not kidding. You won't be sorry. Do you know why the old Burbage is still alive? Do you? Bob the Gorilla's dead. The Pharaoh Banker is no more. He was a real stalker, but still he croaked. And the Slug, too. Norman Four Eyes, Killigan, Scabby Pete, all of them. Only I'm left. Why? Do you know why?"
"You were always a piece of scum," said Redrick, without taking his eyes off the road.
"A vulture. Scum, that's right. You gotta be like that. But they were all the same. The Pharaoh, the Slug. But I'm the only one left. Do you know why?"
"Yes," said Redrick to shut him up.
"You're lying. You don't know. Have you heard of the Golden Sphere?"
"Yes."
"You think it's a fairy tale?"
"You should be quiet," advised Redrick. "You're wasting your strength."
"It's all right. You'll get me out. We've done so much together, you wouldn't actually leave me. You were this tall when we met, knew your father."
Redrick stayed silent. He badly needed a smoke, so he took out a cigarette, crumpled some tobacco into his palm, and tried smelling it. It didn't help.
"You have to get me out," said Burbridge. "It's your fault I'm here. You wouldn't take the Maltese."
The Maltese really wanted to go with them. He paid for their drinks, offered a good deposit, and swore that he could get spec suits. Burbridge, who sat next to the Maltese, shielding his face with a heavy leathery hand, had winked furiously at Redrick.
"Take him! We won't regret it!"
Maybe that was precisely why Redrick had said no. "Your own greed got you here," Redrick said coldly. "Nothing to do with me. Just be quiet." For a while, Burbridge only groaned. He tugged on his collar again and threw his head all the way back.
"You can keep everything," he muttered. "Just don't leave me."
Redrick looked at his watch. It was now almost dawn, but the patrol car still wasn't leaving. It continued to comb the bushes with its searchlights. Their camouflage jeep was hidden somewhere there, very near the patrols, and any moment now it might be discovered.
"The Golden Sphere," said Burbridge. "I found it. Lots of stories about it. Told some myself that it'll grant any wish." "Yeah, right. Any wish. If it granted any wish, I wouldn't be here anymore. I'd be living it up in Europe, swimming in cash."
Redrick looked at him from above. In the flickering blue light, Burbridge's upturned face looked dead. But his glassy eyes were wide open, and they followed Redrick intently without looking away.
"Eternal youth. Like hell I got that. Money. Hell with that, too. But I have my health, and I got good kids, and I'm alive. You couldn't even dream of the places I've been, and I'm still alive." He licked his lips. "That's all I'm asking it for, to let me live, and my health and my kids."
"Shut up,"
Frederick said finally. You sound like an old woman. If I can, I'll drag you out. I feel sorry for your Dina. The girl will be out on the street.
Dina, croaked Burbage. My baby, a beauty. You know, I...